What is up? Welcome to Inside the Game. It is Tuesday night, July 12th. I'm DJ Wheat. Joining me is In Control and Pain User tonight. Idra is he's off in Canada, isn't he?
Oh, he is with his girl.
If by off in Canada you mean visiting his lady friend.
Visiting his lady friend. I think that that's grounds for forgiveness.
Yeah,
is
sure.
That fair?
Technically, he is in Canada.
So, Idra may or may not be joining me tonight.
There it is.
Oh, you guys. Oh, you
there
guys.
It is.
It's going to be a wacky
show. You
know
what? If he ain't going to show up to the show,
we're going to rag on him for not doing so.
Yeah, got him.
That's the rule, right? That's the rule. Pain User, I think you've actually fallen to that a couple times.
Uno.
Once. Good job. All right. Guys, yeah. What's up? Welcome to Inside the Game. Time to get back to the basics. Gosh, like a few weeks ago, we had the show. It was just me and Jeff. Alex Garfield joined us. Now we get to kind of get back to things. And there's a lot to talk about. You guys, we're still going to take a couple of your questions via email that we've got queued up. We're going to be taking some phone calls. But it's been a long weekend, especially
Dude.
For you in control. I could say that watching StarCraft is tiring, but I know from experience that casting StarCraft is even more tiring.
It actually is.
Yeah.
Even with it all split up, it's just, a big part about it too in a live event like that is the, you can't like, when someone comes and says, hey, I'm a big fan, I'd love to meet you, you can't be like, hey.
Yo.
How you doing? I'm busy, I gotta go. You gotta be nice. Which is fine. It's good. It's
Jeff's like, I'm not used to being nice. See?
Jeff's like, boom.
No, I'm not Slasher. It's just that.
No, I understand.
You have to be nice. You got to be on. You know, you gotta make it for them. You gotta make that event worth it. So,
well, all in all, for what it's worth, I think you did a great job, dude. I enjoyed watching it a lot.
Absolutely. I'm in agreement. So we're going to be going more in depth with a few things from the NASL. But I want to start with something here first. Now, a user out there in StarCraft 2 community land made this amazing video, and it's just called One Year Down, and it's basically about StarCraft 2's first year. And I watched it, and guys, I won't lie. There's a lot of nostalgia. There's a lot of nerd chills going on. And there was a little bit of reflection because as I was watching it, I was like, wow, you know, this game has kind of changed my life a little bit. And I think that you guys can probably say the same thing. Now, have either of you seen the video?
What video are you talking about?
It's called 1 Year Down, StarCraft II's First Year. It was made by LaxSC.
Haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's he cried. I did cry, you guys. I was tearing up. It was awesome. And we're not quite at 1 year, July 27th. You saw it,
yeah.
Jeff? What'd you think of it?
Well, it's wrongfully named.
Okay, wrongfully named?
Yeah, it's a few days off. We're not at 1 year yet. No, just kidding. It's really good. I'm actually, like, for aspiring video editors to get those raving reviews that you see on all those websites and stuff, go to me, because I'm actually always impressed with everything I see. I saw the video, I was like, wow, this song works so good with it, and oh my god, the editing is so good. But then, you know, you watch YouTube, and the other comments were like, Jesus Christ. I was making videos like this when I was in the fourth grade. I'm like, I am professional now, so I can tell you it's not that great. So, I thought it was great. Good memories.
What did you think about the implication of sort of what has happened in 1 year? You know, it allowed us an opportunity to look back a little bit, to pull back and go, holy shit, man. Dude, 1 year? This is insane. Jeff, how much, you know, how much movement, growth, expansion did you see in all your years of Brood War?
Well, I think one of the most alarming things for me is that it took a long time to develop a competitive scene for Brood War. It really had to be cultivated and grown, and there's lots of mistakes. In StarCraft II, for a lot of people in the community, it's the competitive atmosphere that makes the game what it is. So, I mean, I remember us running tournaments in the beta, and they showed pictures of Day 9's, you know, King of the Beta tournament, and different events like that, and I think it's pretty cool that StarCraft II is not only an acceptable replacement for Brood War, but the people were so eager to get it competitive that we didn't even wait for the game to get released. And that's kind
of remember like, Green Forest Land?
Yeah.
And like what we're going to now?
I mean, totally different.
It's a completely different atmosphere. Jeff and I both went from like, you know, being pro players to having full-time jobs in the span of a year.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. That's sort of the implications that I was thinking about before is that, and you know what I say, like, this game definitely changed my life, but think about everyone who could say that. How many more people now dedicate their weekends to watching, StarCraft competitions?
There's like a whole new, like, group of StarCraft fans that don't even necessarily play. They're like purely StarCraft spectators, you know? They don't play the game competitively. They don't even have a desire to. They just actually enjoy watching the game, which is awesome because that's what's really sparking the corporate interest is like a lot of the, I mean, NASL hit what, 80,000 this weekend?
Yeah, if not higher.
So yeah, that's just piquing the corporate interest to a level now where we can really turn this whole thing that's been a passion of all of ours forever into an esport.
Well, you know, it kind of brings something interesting on because, of course, a big part of the video was GSL and how much that just exploded StarCraft II on a lot of different fronts.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just announced, if not yesterday, earlier today, I believe it was yesterday, near the end of Kings of 10 is when I heard it, but GSL October Finals are going to be held at BlizzCon in Anaheim. And, I mean, let's just, like, think about that for a second, because not in the entire lifetime of Brood War did any league extend out of Korea unless it was for something like WCG. Where on GameNet would go to wherever WCG was holding its grand finals. So within 1 year, the game has become popular enough in the United States that it warrants GSL to say, you know what, we can bring the GSL finals over to Anaheim, and it will be fucking explosive.
Yeah, and not only that, like the beauty of it is, I'm so thankful to hear this. I didn't even know, but I'm going to be at BlizzCon in Anaheim anyway, so this is just like an added bonus. But it's going to be really cool because there's already going to be all those seats filled. Like, I was at BlizzCon last year, right? They had the Tenacious D concert. There's already, you know, 10,000 people there, and if they do this right, it's going to expose a whole lot of people to what a proper, well-done StarCraft II tournament with good production. And, I mean, I'm sure Tastosis are going to be killing it up there. Everybody's going to love the humor. I mean, it's really just going to bring in so many more people that will start watching it in the future. And that's what I'm really excited about. I think it's just going to blow it up, if done right. Hopefully Blizzard has their servers up this time for BlizzCon. Or maybe they come out with, like, a temporary LAN mode or some shit. But well, they need to really get that together.
Wouldn't be totally surprised. Jeff, I mean, what are your thoughts on that sort of concept or thought that, you know, the popularity of it in the United States, no one's ever doubted that there's been some popularity over in, overseas. But the fact that GOM is saying, yeah, let's do this. Let's bring it to the States.
I think it absolutely is a momentous moment, just like you guys were talking about, in the sense that Korea has always been the mecca of StarCraft. So if you want a live audience that's going to go crazy, the assumption is that you have to do it in Korea. What I think is pretty cool is that that's not the case. I mean, DreamHack fills up these giant tents, you know, all these big European tournaments. NESL had close to 1,000 people. MLGs are pushing the limits in terms of what we thought an audience would be. I really anticipate MLG Anaheim to actually break any kind of record we've seen in the North America scene. So BlizzCon is a good place, and hopefully they utilize it. A lot of times it's like 25,000 people there for WoW. And then like 2,000 people there for StarCraft II. But with StarCraft II exploding the way it has been, I could see that almost flip.
I could too.
You're always going to have the WoW people there, but I think a lot of StarCraft II people.
I could too. And it's always been a very almost exclusive thing. You know, getting BlizzCon tickets sometimes is just, It's a very, very difficult thing to do. You know, that was because of what are you laughing about over there, Payne User? You've tried.
Oh, dude, struggling to get tickets for the last 3 years. Yeah. I mean, it's insanity. Luckily, I have.
I don't even try. Like, I just.
Yeah.
I've gotten the hookup a few times from Blizzard employees. Otherwise, I don't even try because people are like, wow, I'm so lucky I was in there in the first 15 seconds. It got sold out in a record 22 seconds. Like, okay, well, can't do that.
Oh, looks like we got Idra.
Yo,
what is up? Yes, we can. Yes, we can. No, that's okay. How's it going, man?
Pretty good. Just got back from getting food.
Right on.
Got stuck in traffic, so.
Ooh,
here
ooh.
Now.
Do you have your other mic?
No, sorry. I need a replacement headset. It got broke while I was traveling. And I don't have it yet.
Okay. Can you try to turn down just a little bit over there?
Actually, it might be picking up my webcam mic.
Okay. Yeah, there's some crazy stuff going on over there. So, welcome, Idra. Got a nice little crazy screen up here. But continuing on with our topic and Pin User going off of kind of what you said about there's always been an audience at BlizzCon, so that just makes it bigger. It sounds like Blizzard's going to have their global invitational finals there as well, so kind of doubling up on those competitions. But I'll throw this out here real quick. Year one's gone by. We've seen what it's obviously produced, what it's done. Anyone want to make a prediction for the growth into another year?
I mean, I'll go after Pain User. I think Pain User's got a lot to say on the subject.
No, I think it's just going to be huge. That's all there is to it. I mean, I'm not really going to go in depth on it. It's going to be huge for esports, and it's going to be huge for StarCraft too. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
Unless there's some kind of, like, catastrophic meltdown, which it doesn't even matter. I think it'll still be huge, even if there are technical problems or production-related issues or anything like that.
I mean, good StarCraft is good StarCraft.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, they're going to have great, high-quality games. And I love the fact that they're going to have the two tournaments. So hopefully we're going to have a lot of stars from other regions because they're going to do the ladder invite thing again.
Right.
So we're going to have stars from other regions, and then there's also going to be, you know, the whole gamut of Korean players from GSL. And then if they find a way to kind of, you know, combine those into some sort of a super tournament or just run them both separately, either way, there's going to be a ton of StarCraft for people to view at BlizzCon, and I think that's great.
Need more of it. So, Idra, let me hear you again.
Yeah, how's this? Is that better?
It literally sounds like something is trying to kill you, and it might be of alien origin over on your side.
I have no idea. It's my normal setup. Just the internet might be the problem.
Okay.
Is it workable?
What do you guys think? Well, Pain User and Jeff and... and even Scoots, since he's in the chat, if he can hear it. Skit, what do you guys hear?
Oh,
I just hear, you know, like, ripping static.
Drake's, like, sweet, sultry, just silky smooth voice in my ear. It is.
You don't hear the static?
Moments come flashing before my eyes.
All right. Everyone says do it. I'm down. I'm down. Since Jeff says sultry voice, you can't really pass that up. Okay, well, Idra, as you came in, we were kind of talking about year one. Someone made this video. It made us all teary-eyed. Pain User actually had to turn his cam off a little bit because he was crying uncontrollably. But it's talking about the first year of StarCraft II and sort of how much it blew up. And I definitely want to get your thoughts on it. Just sort of, you know, if you think about where you were at 1 year ago, even as the beta was sort of flourishing and how things are now, what are your thoughts on year one?
Oh, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. I think this is pretty much the best-case scenario for StarCraft 2.
You guys are at like a this? You need it to be like a this. With the mouth. Yeah.
All right.
Seeing it go like this, want it to do this. Okay?
Go ahead, Idra.
So, yeah.
Chat saying just push to talk. I say shut the fuck up, chat. Telling these kids how to go. Go ahead, Greg.
I don't really think it could have gotten any better. I think MLG... is the best demonstration, because, like, you look at the first... Well, I wasn't at Raleigh, but I heard it was, like, 35 people and a couple of benches. Then I was at D.C. It was, you know, a decent number of people, but still just a handful of benches. and not that many players, you know, not international caliber players. And then we go to the last event in Columbus, and it's just like absolutely massive and great production quality, no problems, anything. It really just a great event. And then everything in Europe's going well. Korea, people downplay Korea because, you know, it's, we're expecting StarCraft 1, it's supposed to be the mecca of esports. But they still have $40,000, $50,000 first place prize every month. An ongoing team league that supports, what, 8, 10 professional teams where people do that full time. So, no, it's just, everything is absolutely amazing, StarCraft 2 so far.
I can't really disagree with any of that. And so I'm glad we got your opinion. Thanks for joining us, guys. And let's go ahead and move on.
Whoa.
What?
Whoa.
Oh, wait, Jeff, yeah, gosh.
What am I, chopped liver? What is this?
No.
What is this,
go.
Wheat?
I'm sorry, Jeff.
I got my pain user's opinion, got my Idris opinion. Fuck the Protoss.
I started thinking about Poltergeist, that movie, you know, and Caroline, and sorry.
You guys missed it.
Long story.
Earlier, he couldn't hear my microphone, so he just starts going on about the movie Poltergeist and different scenes from it and shit. Like,
dude, Jeff was talking, I heard Jeff like, Wait. And he sounded like that old lady from Poltergeist. Caroline!
The
come
old, like,
into the light, Caroline!
The old, like, Indian.
Yes.
Indian shaman.
That's what he sounded like. And I didn't, what, Scoots was like, dude, he's playing, man! He's fucking, he's trying to play a game and you're screwing it. So, sorry. Word. Jeff.
Word.
Oh. I think the next year in StarCraft 2 is going to yield a level of competition and corporate interest / involvement that we've never seen in StarCraft. And I mean the pro gaming scene in Korea is finally going to blossom to the point where a lot of these teams are signing sponsorships, they're starting to salary their players and really solidify the business side of that over there. I think Kespa should come into play, and we should see a cohesive Korean StarCraft scene. I think abroad, a lot of teams are going to start investing in ways they never thought they would have to. Be it a pro gamer house, expeditions to Korea to improve the play of their players. We already see that to a certain extent with, like, Dignitas, Naniwa, various other players, Thor, Zane. It's still like a pilgrimage, but it's almost a pilgrimage of, like, go to Korea, get better, give a couple shots, but then come back out and dominate and do really well in the scene. And that was not the mentality in Brood War. The mentality was go to Korea to make yourself legitimate in Korea, because that's the only place you want to be legitimate in.
Yeah.
And I really do see big tournaments, NASL, IPL, MLG, DreamHack, GSL. Those are the ones we can name right now, where we're talking about 100,000-ish prize pools, which is just, like, mind-boggling that we have that many to begin with. But I anticipate we'll see more. And I think one thing we can learn from the previous events is people don't just care about prize pools. They don't just care about level of competition. They demand the full package, which I think is actually, as a community, a really good thing. You need to have the stream taken into account. You need to have an amazing live show. You need to have interviewers and concerts and all these things, like, really at the peak of their performance. And if there's problems, you know, the community is very quick to inform you about it, and that could be seen as, like, very negative and bad. And some people do take it there, for sure. But on the large part, I think what I see for the future of StarCraft II is events know that ahead of time, and they plan to that, meaning that the level of acceptability for StarCraft fans is going to continue to rise up. And I think that's really cool, because, you know, we oftentimes joke and laugh about our history, where it used to be really exciting when 15 people would show up to a curtained WCG, you know, event where there's, like, 12 guys who made it there because their moms paid for it. Like, we've left that in the past. You know, now it is, my team flew me out here with the expectation that I do very well. Otherwise, I'm not representing the multi-thousand, you know, $100,000 deal that they've lent us. And it's just getting a lot more serious. And for me, as a person who bases their life around this, I can't help but to be really excited about it.
You know, bringing all those big tournaments into the picture, obviously going to be a huge factor for sort of the top level to grow. But you know what else I've seen over the course of last year is just a stupidly ridiculous amount of competitions that are bringing in multi, like, tiers of players from all the way down to bronze to the platinums to the guys like trying to break into, you know, masters, grandmasters, etc. And so I think that we're going to continue to see new players kind of like popping into the scene, and it's going to be a tough nut to crack, man, in the next couple of years. But I think this, like, having that constantly feeding talent pool is a really, really big plus for it as well.
Yeah, I mean, on that point too, that you can see in the chat, people are saying there's already too many more events, no more. The amazing thing about the situation we're in right now is, fuck, there's too much. I could agree with you, maybe there is, but the mere fact that we're getting crowded out by people who want to take a stab at, like, showing their thing in the community is actually a good thing. If I, as a player, can look at my schedule and say, well, shit, it just doesn't make sense to make that amazing trip to Valencia, Spain, and gosh darn it, this year I guess I won't be going to Australia because I've got to prioritize these other events, then so fucking be it, man. There's other communities like Counter-Strike where they're like, hey guys, we're on the home stretch. We've got that one event 4 months away from here. We're really fucking excited. Like, there is $4,000 on the line. You know, like, do not for one goddamn second forget where we came from. And if you are so presumptuous to think, like, we have too much, I want, so it's perfect for me and my stream viewing, then shut the fuck up, because you don't know where we've came from, and we're really happy where it is.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, land prizes from the past for every game, virtually every game I've played, were like nothing. It's like sometimes even in the hundreds. And then also, on that note, I don't think it's going to be like that forever. Like, right now, it's blowing up, it's expanding, but I really think it's going to come down to this. I almost envision it as this UFC-style approach where, you know, you have other, you know, you have like Strike Force and all these other different organizations. Eventually, the top dogs are either going to buy out or just exceed the expectation by so far that all these other little pop-ups, you know, small little $50,000 to $100,000 tournaments just aren't going to be able to compete. And you
you really think that could happen?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's going to be like a UFC style venue sort of thing where, you know, these tournaments just, the venues get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the live audiences get larger and larger. Stream audiences get larger.
Are you talking from a phenomenon point of view, or are you talking about like one of these leagues will emerge as the sort hypothetical UFC?
I think there will be multiple. I don't think any one is going to be able to corner esports, because with the UFC, I mean, they essentially started the sport of mixed martial arts. StarCraft has been around forever. StarCraft 2 had its own community beforehand. You know, it's not like MLG or IGN's IPL. It's not like we fostered competitive StarCraft 2.
Why am I sweating just sitting here?
Okay. Idra, did you want to make a comment on that?
Here in Phoenix, Jeff. I kind of agree with Taylor. Definitely agree with Jeff that it's certainly a good thing. There's no better problem to have than actually having too much of it, because either everyone just keeps getting to pick their best events, the best players win the best things, and then there's still room for lower-tier players to support themselves through tournaments and stuff, which is awesome. Or what I think is more likely is what Taylor said, the competition will win through after the bubble. I wouldn't say the bubble burst, because I think it is going to be a long-term thing, but a lot of these leagues will die off or be absorbed, and we'll have the bigger ones that you focus on, and then, you know, the smaller tournaments that aren't as relevant. And that just means that those tournaments that went through, they're going to be absolutely amazing. They're going to be the best at everything, because they're the ones that people choose to watch over everything else. So I think the competition is absolutely great for the scene.
I agree. I mean, the competition is really big. And when you what, Jeff?
What? We just need to limelight that point, because there's a lot of pseudo-businessmen in the stream chat, and it's starting to aggravate me, if you can't tell. I'm a little tired from the weekend, so my fuse is a little bit shorter, but they're like, fewer tournaments equals more spectators and more sponsorships. If I have 3 plates of food, and I break it down to 2 plates of food, you can say it's more food, and more people can eat off it. The argument is that, like, competition, that's a huge word that's being used here. I really need people to focus on that. Like, if there's these great tournaments and then these not that great tournaments, they will have less spectators, they will have less sponsors, so they'll die. And then the bigger ones will have to escalate their level so that they compete with the other big tournaments. That is what we want. We want more tournaments competing with more tournaments.
Right.
We don't want fewer tournaments that have magically more sponsorships because there's not other tournaments.
However, in the same token, we don't want these tournaments to step over each other either.
I don't know. I
think
we do.
In a world, they don't, but it's going to happen. And
it's
going
to happen.
That's what's going to cause that competition that forces the tournaments to step it up and, you know, not have the problems we've seen in past tournaments. MLG, after Dallas, they knew if they had another event like that, they'd get they'd become irrelevant. IPL and NASL and whatnot would pass them over. So they spent $2 million or whatever, bring in satellite trucks, bring in what all the other changes they made, and then they ran a really fucking good event in Columbus because they couldn't get by doing shitty. So I think overlapping is good. That's what creates the competition and makes everyone better.
I'm thinking from a player perspective, though.
Oh, okay, yeah, obviously, yeah. But ideally, we end up in a situation where we don't need to play a bunch of tournaments because we have this one that's ongoing for $50,000, $100,000, X amount of dollars a month. And it's so awesome that all the sponsors won't pay us enough that we only have to have that one tournament. That's what we're aiming for, I think.
Is that better with the fan?
Yeah, it is. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, it's a lot better.
Okay. Any final comments on this, guys? I mean, some great points, and obviously, shit's only going to start getting bigger. More people are going to be coming on.
Just to reiterate, because I'm so awesome. I've said this a long time ago. Like, I said a lot of dumb things about the NASL, and you know, I've gotten flack for it. But let's also give credit where credit's due to Jeff. I also said that if the NASL can create competition for other tournaments that have to raise their bar, prize pool, level of games, production, whatever, then it's done its job. And I can really rest my hat on that. The more leagues that are offering bigger prize pools and, you know, offline finals or whatever it is, whatever their gimmick is to try and attract more people, the more leagues we have doing that. It's not like it's just the NASL. It's IPL, it's MLG, it's NASL, GSL. It's everybody. The better. You know, the host at DreamHack, 2GD, Too Good, that concept had previously been not really used in tournaments, and everybody fucking loved it. This trollish, hilarious guy who isn't a commentator, but between games he's doing, like, interviews, interacting with the crowd and stuff like that. I think that concept, as, like, basic and simple as it is for other areas of entertainment, be it, you know, an award ceremony or a show of some sort, for us it was new, and they tested the waters. Of course, there's been other hosts. I'm not trying to say it was the first time it's ever been done. But on that level, I think that was one of the first times that I've at least recognized it. And it was awesome. So I think you're going to see stuff like that. IPL, what was their big thing? It was their absolute online production. I mean, you just could not look at that and not be impressed. Crisp picture, amazing overlays, no problems whatsoever. And that is the standard for online major Star Leagues. You know, all these things, I look at them. And yeah, they're competition
that are pre-recorded,
but they're raising for everybody.
That are pre-recorded.
you're gonna harp on that,
dude. They're two completely different things. Doing a pre-recorded broadcast and doing a live broadcast are like two fucking totally different mountains to climb.
I totally agree. I still try to approach it. I like getting all my content completely fresh. Like, not having seen the replays, not knowing about the brackets or anything like that. Like, I have this huge, like, pet peeve at work where, like, you know.
Yeah, it sucks, man.
If anything like that comes my way, I'm, like, running the other direction or earmuffs or whatever, you know.
Spoilers! Well, year one was certainly great, guys, and I think we can all agree that it's made major impacts on our lives. Let's hear it for another great year as we're going to be turning around again.
It's ridiculous.
Can't wait.
Like, literally 1 year ago, I was painting barns and houses for $100 after a hard day's work and being like, I can go buy so much ramen. I'm so happy. And now with the growth of StarCraft 2, you know, I'm living comfortably and I'm excited about new opportunities and like getting to choose whether or not I want to do things. Like, I've said no to projects. Right. I've quit jobs, not because I can afford to, but because I'm in a position of luxury where it's like, that's not what I want to do with my time, so I don't have to do that. And I have to take a moment and recognize StarCraft is why I have that ability, and I can be nothing but appreciative to that. I have to serve that cause.
Amen.
Yeah.
And you can eat premium ramen now. The 99 cent ones.
Dude, I've upgraded to crap.
Can't even have an egg in it.
Oh, yeah, I'm all about the egg and the ramen. That's like my go-to.
Egg and the ramen, kimchi and spam.
Yeah, tapatio in there.
Spam. I don't know about the spam.
Spam cooked in egg batter. Like, you mix up some eggs and you dump the spam in and you fry it up. It's amazing.
Sweet, sweet. Next Inside the Game, cooking with Idra. It's coming. Like, today we're going to teach you how to make ramen. Seriously.
A webisode of Greg whipping up spam and eggs.
I mean, you know how many people would watch that shit, house? Pain user? Oh, my
God.
Cook
for a gaming team house for sure.
Oh, my God. Wow.
There actually is a cooking show for esports.
It really?
Attracted what was that,
JP? It attracted literally dozens of people.
So. Oh, yeah. I heard about that.
We tried to do one way back in the day during EG, and it was like the biggest failure ever. But
yeah. Well, hold your breath. I mean, there could be bigger failures than cooking.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. I don't know that we're ready for the cooking shows quite yet, Jeff, but we'll get there eventually. Let's talk about our other under the microscope thing. I know, Jeff, you were really excited to talk about this, and a lot of the fans wanted to hear your guys' opinions. We're gonna start, I guess, by focusing on the finals match, which is the NASL finals of Puma versus MC. And Jeff, you kind of said that you were excited to talk about this because you felt like maybe and kill me if I'm wrong here, but that the way this matchup was played is sort of was done in a way that it will end up changing the matchup a little bit. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Why don't you elaborate?
I think both players encompass the cutting edge forward way of playing that matchup right now. We've been seeing a lot of Ghost being mixed into Bioplay at earlier stages. I mean, it used to be the belief was that if you had any kind of Ghost out when Colossus came walking around, you were the biggest dum-dum in the whole world, and you're about to die, it's a big joke, lol. But then kind of with Thorzane in the TSL, we saw, actually, it's perfectly fine, and you don't need 25 Vikings to counter Colossus. And
he would go up to, like, 10 to 15 Ghosts at times.
Oh, yeah, I'm going
to
talk about that, too. I mean, that's something that's... Cloaked Ghosts, EMPing everything, sniping Templar. They actually have a pretty good chunk of health, so they're able to withstand a lot of damage. And also, something that we've talked about in the past as well, is just the adherence and respect to harass. It used to be that a lot of these Terran players were either like sit back and mass macro kind of guys for one big push, or they were pure harass. That was kind of their gimmick. But Puma was bold. He was able to maintain harass throughout the entire game, and even feature harass in conjunction with his aggression. And, I mean, just the level of play from Puma, I really do feel like he's one of, if not the best Terran player in the world right now. His TVZ was not even close, by the way. I was really happy, as weird as this is, to say that Sen didn't win, because I think Sen would have just got absolutely obliterated in the finals, and we got saved from watching a beatdown.
Oh, really? You think his TVZ is even better?
I mean, what he did... The match before that was just gross. Just his timing, like he's so unpredictable. He did a two reactor Hellion opener that just like flat out. If you as Azur don't have like four spine crawlers or open Roach, you're dead. You're just dead. There's just absolutely too many Hellions, and then he would follow it up with a blue flame Hellion off a two fact, and it would look like it's mech, but then he'd immediately switch to bio and hit the same timing only with like four or five more tanks. It was absolutely disgusting how completely put together Puma was.
Yeah.
And that's without getting to MC, but I want you guys to talk about it first before we get to MC.
I mean, for me, like, I don't know if it's necessarily going to change the entire way that the matchup was played, but one thing I saw from both players is that they're hitting all of the incremental steps along the way. Like, MC's not just teching straight to Colossus. He's adding Colossus in much later after Templar tech and mixing Archons in as well. And then you also see, like you were saying, Jeff, the Puma not skipping Ghosts just to immediately go up the Vikings. He's getting Ghosts incrementally at an early stage in the game and then continuing to add them in. Now, the thing for me about Puma that was just absolutely amazing is that his drop play, like drop play has always been super important in TVP. It's been the way the matchup is played. As Terran, you have to find a way to inflict damage on the Protoss As he's playing that passive style, as he's taking his third, he's continuing to build up, accumulate that sentry energy, all that good stuff. You have to find a window of opportunity to do damage. The thing about Puma that was crazy for me is that he was forcing situations where he was guaranteed to do damage with his drops. And in a few games, it kind of backfired. Like the game on Tal Darim, he got a little willy-nilly with his drops. He was going all over the place. He lost like three or four medevacs full worth of units, and it was still a close game just because he wasn't able to do all that damage that he normally did with the drops. But he would push into the front, lure MC out, start an engagement, and then he would be dropping two different places simultaneously at the exact same time. I mean, that is like unheard of.
Perfectly. Like, you have to, if you can check out those VODs, I don't know if the replays will be released, whatever. Every time he dropped his Marines or Marauders in the mineral line, they never just sat there and stimmed. He'd move them in between the minerals so that there'd be a narrow, like, alley. And he always got two or three times the value of each drop. It was absolutely absurd how well-controlled he was.
Yeah, I mean, from a spectator point of view, it was really sort of mind-numbing and just jaw-dropping how he really looked unstoppable. You know, like, people always talk about the changing of the guard so often here in the first year of StarCraft III, but, you know, he showed a level of play, even though it was like a full game series, that looked unstoppable when he was playing at his best. And the drops, like, absolutely, like you said, Jeff, positioning, there was never an idle drop. There was never a drop that just, like, went in and was sacrificed unless it was specifically set up to fuck him up somewhere else. Like, it was really, really gorgeous the way it all went down.
No, he was playing the positional war unbelievably well. I mean, it was on a whole nother level that you haven't seen out of any other Terrence before. And he was even managing to do damage with drops when MC was opening Phoenixes. I mean, whenever I'm playing against a high-level Protoss that opens Phoenixes, like, my drop play gets shut down. He was still finding windows of opportunity. He was dropping and microing the individual medevacs away from the Phoenix while the Marines were coming out and individually stimming the Marines and picking off the Phoenixes, like, as he was dropping. I mean, that was just unreal. That one drop that he did on Shattered Temple, straight across with the two medevacs as early as possible, still managed to pick off three Phoenix and do a ton of damage and get out of there. And then also, more critically, how he continued to find the important tech structures and pick them off before the key upgrades would come into play. He stopped charge twice, I think. And got the Twilight Council. I don't think he got any robos, but just stopping charge in both those games played such a huge factor, because then he was able to hit a timing push where MC has, you know, a billion zealots, but none of them have charge yet. So it's like it completely shifts the balance of power, and I thought that was amazing. And he picked off a forge or two as well that were upgrading. It's just really impressive.
I want to ask you guys a question, and Iter, I'm not sure, did you get to see the finals? Are we traveling?
No, I was actually gone for the weekend. Okay. I didn't see it.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you could tell just by the discussion that, you know, there was a lot of, like, really, really sick drop play coming out from Puma.
I'm not at all surprised that Puma is starting to kick ass. He was actually on Istra while I was in StarCraft I, and they were really, really excited about him. He was considered one of the big up-and-comers. He was ridiculously talented. He had some nerd problems on TV on stage, and he wasn't very experienced yet, but they thought he was going to be ridiculously good. So, well, I'm not at all surprised he's starting to kick ass.
Your comment then is a perfect little segue into my question is, and I feel like there are a lot of players out there that can sort of conduct the orchestra in the same way that Puma did, but Puma seemed to just, like, I don't know, whatever he was doing there, waving his little stick, you know, making the orchestra play, just seemed to be more effective than even some of the best we've seen in the past. Does anyone want to take any comments on that? I mean, obviously, Edward talking a little bit about his history.
He was known more as a smart player than a mechanical player. Like, there were tons of players who were nearly perfect in terms of multitasking, but he was just really good strategically, tactically. And that's a lot more important in StarCraft II, since mechanics are so easy. And from the sounds of it, coordinating drops, hitting multiple fronts, really good timings, just focusing on what's important to do, like taking out specific upgrades and then hitting a timing to take advantage of. But that is the kind of thing he was good at. So, you know, it kind of fits in perfectly with what I would expect from him. I wouldn't say every talented B-teamer from StarCraft 1 is going to be able to do that. He has a specific skill set that really transfers well to StarCraft 2.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. yeah, just like the mechanics of StarCraft II being so much more simplistic. If you have a really good strategical mind, I think that's definitely one of the more valued skills to excel at in StarCraft II for certain. And then just as far as what you were saying, Weed, about him, you know, orchestrating the perfect game, painting the Picasso or whatever, I mean, it was really pretty to watch, because that was just on a level that I hadn't seen before, and it completely changed the way that I'm thinking about TVP now. I'm definitely going to try to incorporate a whole lot more of those distraction tactics where you're using your main army as like a it's just a distractionary force. You're not even trying to go for that main engagement, while, and that frees up opportunities for drops all over the place if you divert their attention. And I was doing that before, but I mean, not nearly to that extent. And the thing that was so amazing about the way that he does it was the crisp timing. Sometimes I'll try and do something like that, but my timing window will be 5-10 seconds off, and it gives the Protoss player enough time to blink some stalkers over, shut down the drops. But he had all of that timed out to the point where he was guaranteed doing damage. I mean, sniping probes, sniping pylons everywhere, key structures, and that's what's so important about the way that he did it. It was just his timing was flawless on everything, and his builds were so well planned out. Like, that was just really, really impressive stuff. But Jeff, what do you think about Game 7? Like, what happened with MC there?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, too.
What is going on? Like,
Protoss is a pretty opportunistic race. I think with the Warpin ability and Chronoboost, it very much so speaks to the ability to be like, oh, I think I can do this thing. And everything about the Protoss race gives kind of backup to that idea. So that's why you see a lot of games where there's a ridiculous cannon rush, looks like it never should have happened, or perhaps successful proxy pylons in base, like in Game 7, minus the word successful. But I'm trying to get at the concept that you go into a game and no Protoss is thinking, I'm going to throw down two pylons in his base and start warping in off of three gates. They're not saying that. It's just that they can see the opportunity for that. And he saw Command Center first. He saw a late barracks, and he said, well, I scouted him first. I can put down a couple pylons, and I could just overrun him and win myself $50,000. And I think it would have worked to a certain extent, but he did a lot of weird choices. Like, it didn't really work at the beginning, so he should have given up on it as opposed to the two or three extra warp-ins he did.
Yeah.
And then also, he diversified his Chronoboost. He actually spent, I think it was two extra Chronoboosts on his gateway to get stalkers into that base faster, when had he just warped in, or, excuse me, used him on the warp gate upgrade a few more times, he would have had just that much faster warp gate. And he was also off of three gates, which is very impromptu. You could tell that this is something I'm sure he has not worked out to its optimal state. But it's something that happens to Protoss players, and we're either praising them for their genius, or we're talking about how dumb and what a big meltdown it was. And for MC to make it a game after that, it had to be that Puma moves out and gets his army slaughtered by positioning, which is exactly what happened. So I was kind of sad when the game didn't reset after that, because MC made some blunders after that too.
Yeah, it seemed like in that final game everything was just kind of falling apart for him. In the early stages of the game, I was so impressed when he was able to collapse in the middle of the map and just annihilate Puma's army. I thought he was going to get back in it from there, but Puma took that super quick third and played that really defensive style and just held the six gates so well. But yeah, I just didn't know. Generally, when you see that, it will be with like a four gate, usually, right? If that's pre-planned out, you'll go with a four gate if you try and hide a pylon or something like that.
I mean, you can three gate expand, so that, I mean, maybe in MC's head this was a glorified three gate expand, because this expansion did go down fairly soon. It was in conjunction with the warp-ins, so and it's deceiving, too. If you kill enough SCVs and you get them pulled off the mineral line for long enough, and if you can keep them from mining gas, even if you don't kill them outright with that attack or kill a bajillion SCVs, you can do enough damage. The Terran economy is fairly fragile, despite all the jokes we make about mules. They don't make as many SCVs, so each one they lose is a higher percentage of their economy. And especially if they're making so many cuts to get that command center down and faster like they did, you'd be surprised how bad a Protoss can do at that stage and still be okay with Chronoboost. But one of the things I want to talk about too, and we can definitely get back to this, but I really think that MC revolutionized, or at least displayed revolutionary PvT there as well. I'm not trying to say that this is the first time any of this stuff has been done. Of course, I've been seeing it up and down in the GSL matches. Korean Protoss has been using this stuff for a while now, but I think MC encompasses like the highest end quality of these strategies. And I mean, just going for charge first, really, really emphasizing the positioning of your zealots as opposed to going on a more stalker-based army. There was a couple times where he transitioned to Colossus after opening Templar, which is something I talked about a long time ago on State of the Game, I believe, where Terrans don't have Vikings at that stage. They see Templar, they get Ghosts out, they don't switch to Vikings, and you walk out with four Colossus against a non-Viking Terran army, they're dead. Like, unless you just have this terribly small Protoss army, they're completely dead. So I think a lot of the stuff MC did, the whole weekend I was writing PBT in my head. I was like, this is what I'm going to go home and practice because this guy gets it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Zealots are way undervalued. I remember back in the day. Yeah, even you were telling me how terrible Zealots were, and I was going on about Guardian Shield plus armor plus Force Field just makes, and then with Charge in the mix, he gets that early charge, and that just makes it so much better because they close the distance, then the Force Fields go down, and just if you compare like Zealots just as a unit all around and Stalkers just as a unit all around, Stalkers versus Marines, Stalkers versus Marauders, Marines and Marauders are both fantastic against Stalkers, and they're also both fantastic against Sentries just in straight up combat. The only thing that can really contend with the Bio Ball is obviously Zealots, I mean on an even playing field, but the huge problem was that people weren't getting charged fast enough, so they couldn't close the distance. And yeah, Force Fields work, but Force Fields without charge lots, like if you go Zealot Sentry but you don't have the super early charge, it's not nearly as effective. Terran can stim and get out of there, and you can use medevacs to pick up and drop behind the force shields, all kinds of stuff. But I totally agree with you. I think the early charge and the armor upgrades just makes the Protoss ball a whole new monster. And then he also just kind of randomly mixes in the Archons from time to time. If he does a DT opener, he can use the DTs to eventually transition into Archons. And he was also just mixing in Archons with Templar like well before he got Storm. And just mixing those in there, and I thought that helped
a
lot.
His builds could be described as Charge Lot, Stalker, Archon into Templar. Each and every one of the games, he would warp in a good four Templar and make them Archons right away, if not Templar. And his adherence to positioning of Archons was remarkable. I mean, every time those Marauders stacked up and got sandwiched in, you could actually see the area of effect of the Archon, and I remember myself, this show could be called I'm So Dumb, because I was just, I'm going to have to flip my opinion completely around on the Archon, and pretty much the Zealot. Like, after I watched MC that weekend, I was like, alright, I get it. Yeah. The Archon's freaking amazing. Like, if it had a bigger area of effect, I think the game would be completely broken, because of how good it is against Marauders, I think.
Yeah, there was one battle, I was it on maybe Tal'Darim, where, like, I thought Puma just had it for sure. I mean, he cleaned up almost all the Zealots. He dodged most of the force fields. He hit a few good EMPs. And then there were maybe four or five Archons remaining, a couple Stalkers, and a handful of Sentries. But they had already closed the distance, and they were on top of the Bio Ball, and he didn't really have anywhere to go. And, I mean, wow. Like, that, I had never really seen Archons just shred through a Bio Ball like that. It's pretty impressive how much damage they can do when used properly.
I just throw out a few random comments based off of a couple of things you said. You talked about the Zealot, and then of course how the charge upgrade just can make them ridiculously sick. And it does go to say the whole sniping of the Twilight Council, not once in sort of a, oh, that was a cute little move, you know, look what he pulled off there, but actually multiple times. And although I think a third time, although there was nothing upgrading, that kind of crippled MC in a few of those games. You know, nothing, I don't know if you have comments on that, but it really, like I mentioned, you saw that happen the first time. And I remember you guys, Jeff, like, you know, oh my God, this is huge because look at the Zealot army that he had. But then when he just consciously went in and did it the second time, it was just almost, it was just pretty ridiculous how that all went down.
Just the army positioning, you're saying?
Well, I mean, just the fact that Puma was kind of aware, I believe, with what MC was doing,
yeah,
and you know, crippled his tech accordingly.
And, I mean, we kind of coined it during the cast, but Puma reminds me just of a surgical precision. Like each and every game, he opens up with a broad idea. Like, okay, this game I want a Blue Flame Hellion Harass. This game I'm doing Cloak Banshee. This game I'm doing two racks pressure. But then from there, you could see him funneling down his strategies, not to what he wanted to do to keep pace, but what he wanted to do in relation to the Protoss player. He played reactive. He played reactive in army composition, but he played aggressive in harass, which I thought was a really interesting combination of ideas. And, I mean, I think one of the best games I've ever seen in StarCraft II history was that game on Terminus, where I really felt like Puma could not have played. I mean, okay, there's one thing, and I'll talk about that in a second, that I think he could have done better, but his harass and macro and decision-making through the first, like, 15, 20 minutes of that game was perfect. It was just ridiculously perfect. The drops in conjunction with the Banshees.
I completely agree with you 100%. I was blown away when he lost that game. And that's a testament to how ridiculously good MC is, because I had the exact same thoughts as you watching that game. I was like, he is all over the place. He's doing so well with the drops, so well with the Banshees. I thought he had a timing window where he was going to hit the natural, but he backed off. I thought he was just going to outright win the game right there on his first push, but then Puma pulled back. He saw MC's army, and he wasn't confident that he could win right there, and he pulled back. And I think that's what gave him the opportunity to get back in that game. But, yeah, that was some amazing, amazing StarCraft right there.
Well,
I don't know
that, and Puma fell for the trap that a lot of turns do, where he was not continuing to produce SCVs throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
So it was interesting because he'd have a Banshee with 15 kills. He had another one with 5. He'd drop and pick off 2 pylons, kill 4 probes, pick up and leave for, like, 0 damage. And then we'd check the income tab, and MC's up, like, 20 probes. I mean, Puma was so focused on his micro and his aggression, and he just, like, kind of forgot about building probes. So that ended up, I mean, if I was Puma, I would still be shaking my head and pounding the table, though, because, sure, you can forget to build probes, but you're massacring your opponent's probes. How the hell is he out ahead? MC's small battle management, just disgusting. Just absolutely gross, the choices he was making that whole game. If anyone hasn't seen it, they need to go check it out. It's one of the best I think I've ever seen.
Well, I want to take just a real quick break here, but I want final thoughts here on this game. Or we could just take a break if you guys want to keep on breaking some of this stuff down. I want to get to a few questions and then the open phones. What do you guys want to do? You want to keep breaking this game down, or do you want to move on to a couple emails?
Q&As are usually good. It just kind of gives us an idea of what people want to hear about.
Yeah. Okay, right on. So we're just going to take a really, really quick break, guys. And when we come back, we'll be going on to our email. And remember, you can send us email at itg@onemoregame.tv. Guys, don't go away. We'll be right back. Back. Welcome back to Inside the Game. That was not the prettiest of transitions, but that's okay, guys. As we go into our second hour here We've got some emails that come in, and thank you guys, everyone who does fire these emails in. We really appreciate it. You can send your emails over to itg@onemoregame.tv. And this is something we actually haven't talked about before directly. And anytime I see emails come in bulk, which means that it must be talked about somewhere, I like to address it. And Idra, this is going to kind of come over to you to start, and then of course we'll get your colleagues' impressions on it as well, because it might be a bit Zerg favored. So you get first voice, and then we'll see what everyone else says. Okay. There have been some discussions. I have read a few of them. And Mark wants to hear your thoughts of the host in regards to allowing Overlord creep spread before Lair. You're gonna shoot it down right away?
I think there's a lot better changes you can make to Overlord, and you would get situations where close positions it messes with building plate. Like, imagine close air on Metalopolis, all of a sudden Protoss can't wall in, and then Speed and Rush has become overpowered.
Yeah, so. Taren can't build a single building
in
his base.
You really got, like, a bunch of emails about that?
Yeah.
Believe it or not, yeah. Yeah, well, obviously they're from Zergs. And, I agree with you. It's like, and I had a feeling that you're going to say this, because when you think about that whole concept of just basically blocking someone's ability to do that, the real root of the question, right, is how do I achieve some better creep spread? And so I've talked about this before, but what harm would be in an extra 25 energy on the queens? Or do you think that is too much of a critical decision to take away?
Max mana or it's
no, spawning. I mean starting.
No, I think that would be too good too. It's just like
off an inject and a creep tumor.
Yeah, right off the bat.
No, creep spread is good as is. I don't know. Maybe make creep tumors more robust so it's not so easy to clear. But I think that would become overpowering itself as well. But yeah, if you just have an extra queen, like you make your third one too early, or you have a fourth one running around.
What about creep tumors that auto spread themselves?
That's no fun. What? Okay, all right. Jeff's obviously getting it. All right, Jeff, I like Jeff. You actually got emails about, dude, you have no idea, bro. You would be shocked the amount of stuff you have to swim through. I had a feeling that's where you'd go. I mean, Idra playing the good guy card. I'm surprised. Maybe just into it. Yeah, let's do that. Let's go ahead and petition for it.
Oh, I would love it. I think, you know, make up for patch 1.1 or whatever. Fuck Taren.
So this one came in, and it's kind of related to the NASL topics, and it's going to kind of go out to all you guys, and Idra, I know that you didn't quite watch it, but it's in regards to the Sen and MC matchup, I'll just read what Kyle has to say. Sen had a really good chance to beat MC in a matchup. MC said no Zerg could win. MC's action spoke louder than his words when the game ended, and MC gave Sen the thumbs up. So how did Sen take one of the best Protoss players in the world to the brink when the matchup is supposedly so hard for Zerg? Are Baneling drops that good? Did MC have an off day? Did Sen have the perfect counter for the Stargate play? For those of you that saw it, you guys, what do you think?
It's a couple things. You want to go, Painter?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
All I was going to say is that Sen played phenomenal. And he made all those games really, really close. And the few games that, in my opinion, well, the reason he lost a few of the games was that in order for Zerg to make it happen and win those big battles against modern Protoss, there's so much going on. There's so many things that they have to do. They have to be, you know, hitting their fungals. They have to be getting a huge surround. They need to bring the Overlords in at the proper time, drop the Banelings directly on the sweet spot, somehow prevent the Protoss from getting away, hopefully trap them against like a wall or have some sort of terrain advantage. There's just so many things that need to go right for the Zerg to crush the Protoss ball, and I feel like Sen just missed it a couple times where his Overlords dropped the Banelings a little bit late, or the Overlords came in from a weird angle and he got a few of them sniped. So I think it's very, very difficult to execute for Zergs now to win in the late, mid, and late game. And I think Sen just made a few little hiccups that ended up costing him the games. And MC just didn't make any mistakes.
Jeff, do you agree?
Few little hiccups.
Okay, a few major hiccups in the two games that you lost.
This actually broke my brain at the event, so I'm going to revisit it because I love this show and you guys so much. A Zerg up three bases versus a Protoss makes 15 Broodlords, an unprecedented number. Zero anti-air. He had four Infestors, no Corruptors.
Yeah. Infestors are Zerg's best anti-air.
What, Greg?
Infestors are Zerg's best anti-air versus Protoss.
Yeah, he only had four. He needed like 15 is what I'm saying. He should have flipped that number. Six Infestor Broodlords.
Four Broodlords are useless.
They honestly are. Like, the six is the same as 15 if the Protoss is prepared or not. Now, the Protoss, at that exact moment, did the one reaction that used to be what everyone thought was the best until Infestors were, like, discovered by the Zerg players. Now, if you mass Void Raise, you're basically asking to be murdered. Like, you're gonna die against every single Zerg ever.
Unless you don't put them all on one hotkey.
Well, I mean, unless you don't make Infestors, which is what fucking Sen did at that one moment. So, both these guys didn't scout each other. They just started doing these things. And I was sitting there like I was watching, like, my mom's side of the family and my dad's side of the family in different vans, like, driving at each other, going 80 miles per hour, not paying attention. I was like, no, it's gonna ruin everything. like Sen was supposed to win. And MC rolled the dice because he was in a desperate situation, so he had to. And Sen rolled the dice because he was dominating and he absolutely didn't have to, so it was really sad. That was the major error, and that was what I disagree with the pain user. But what I do want to say is that situation going normally, Sen wins. I don't think there's a single person that would argue, no, MC had him right where he wanted him. He's down three bases, shambles. He had half an army, and he just started making Void Rays off of three Stargates. It's like the best situation for Protoss. No,
dude, those Void Rays just absolutely cleave.
Well, I mean, if you show up with 20 Void Rays versus a Zerg that has no anti-air,
you're
fucking dead.
It was
brutal.
It was brutal. The game I was referring to where he made the huge mistake was the one with the key Banelink drop that he missed. It was actually the same game. The key Banelink drop that he missed outside the natural when MC was first moving out and he tried to engage him right there. And he brought the Overlords after the engagement and then kind of just like trickled the Banelings in but didn't get them on top of the ball. And it's like things like that just kept happening throughout the series to Sen, and I agree with you. It was like really hard to watch because I was totally pulling for Sen.
But a big part of the reason why Sen, like the question is, why was Sen able to push the best Protoss to the brink like that? It's because I feel like, well, thank you, Payne. Yeah, that's it. Moving on.
All right. No, Jeff. Do you want to elaborate on fucking good? Jeff froze.
I can't really talk about the game since I didn't see it. But as to the Baneling drops, since that was mentioned in the question, I think it's much better to invest your gas in your Infestors as your damage dealer. It's just Baneling drops versus armies never seem to go as well as they should, and they're like Bing said, they're ridiculously hard to actually execute. And even when you do, it's up to Protoss to blink micro and force field properly to nullify it. It's just Baneling drops kind of suck versus armies. It's much better to make mass Infestor and just try and kill everything with fungal.
Alright, so, sorry, I'm having some problems with InControl, so we may or may not get him back. I don't know. We'll wait for him to come. I want to go on to the next question then, and we'll let InControl answer that when he goes. Recently announced, this one's from Pedro. His question is pretty simple. What is your opinion regarding the new ladder fusions, where the LA server now links with the NA, the RU with the EU, and the TW with the KR? Will it have any effect on kind of Idra? You've talked a little bit about practice. What do you guys think it will have, like, a larger effect on things? What are your thoughts?
It'll be irrelevant. Like, the good players from the smaller servers from Latin America, Russia, and Taiwan, they already play on the major servers just because you can't get good practice on the smaller ones. So, I mean, it's nice for the casual players from those regions, but it's not going to change anything at all for competitive scene.
Okay. What if, I mean, it could certainly open up the I guess the amount of people that the lower leagues might be able to play. Like, it might expand that audience a little bit, probably because there's more of those players than there are the grandmasters like you're talking about, Idra. I don't know, Pinus, are your thoughts?
I mean, I don't think it's really going to affect it that much either.
No. So you guys all think from way up, like the top level of players. I personally think it's cool just because it will make that lower league audience much bigger.
Yeah,
there's that. But when I see something, about connecting servers, I'm like, oh my god, are they finally gonna let me play on Korea? And then I see no, and I'm just mad. So
and then you just don't.
Nothing else really matters to me.
All right, that's fair enough. That's fair enough, Idra. All right, let me see if I can go. Okay, this is actually a live question. So someone responded based off of something that you had said, Idra, about Puma. Idra spoke about Puma's extremely high strategy intelligence, which makes up for his low mechanics. My question is, what is better to have, strong mechanics with low game IQ, such as repeating a strategy over and over but very well, or weaker mechanics with a high game IQ? That's from
I wouldn't say he has weak mechanics. I mean, he was still a competent StarCraft 1 player, which requires ridiculous mechanics. And he's easily good enough to execute anything he wants to do in a game like StarCraft 2. I would say, in general, StarCraft 2 is more focused on being a smart player than a fast player, but both are necessary to be the highest level. It's pretty easy to be fast enough to play at the highest level.
Yeah, anybody who's like that level in Brood War is going to have more than enough tools as far as mechanics are concerned to play StarCraft 2 at the highest level. I mean, just period.
Let's go ahead and take another question here, as actually a lot of people call in. Let's see. We've heard the recent announcements of the new players that are going to be at MLG Anaheim. We've talked a little bit about them before, but any thoughts on the two new actually they've announced several more as well, the Korean list that's heading to Anaheim?
Dongregu is really, really good. Excited to see him play, and hope, well, I can't really say that, but hopefully he finally gets a Code S spot, because I want to see him play against like the best players other than just GSGL. And MVP seems to have kind of fallen off lately, but still, you know, for this level of tournament, he's going to be ridiculously good. I don't even know which Koreans are going in the open bracket.
We've also got Choya Foyu. Is it Slayer's Alicia? I'm going to miss another one.
Because it was Gonzi.
Okay, that's right. That's right.
Alicia and Gonzi are pretty good, not great, and Choya kind of sucks. But no, Dongregu and MVP are big.
I'm curious to see MVP a little bit, because like you
I'm
said...
I'm curious to see Dongregu, man.
I am as well.
So
I mean,
impressive in GSTO.
Yeah.
Yeah, fucking...
I recommended him
to
all my friends for their fantasy league teams, and they were all like, nope. Guy's not going to do anything, and then boom. Only two of my friends listen to me. They got hooked up with some points.
Good. Good for them. Good for them. All right. Well, we could take a few more questions. I'm not sure what happened to In Control over there. So I think we'll probably go ahead and open up the phone lines. A little Q&A for who is left standing here, Pain User and Idra. We'll go ahead and get that loaded up here, guys. Oh, Idra must be talking to someone else.
Sorry, what?
Oh, I just saw you talking, and then your mic went quiet. I figured you were talking to someone else. You could Skype us at DJ Later, telephone 909-581-8519. And I'll take our first caller here, as we have Alex joining us. Alex, welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Hello. I'm a silver level Protoss, and I was just wondering what you guys think about practice regimes. I mean, is it beneficial for me to just grind out a bunch of games, or is it worth it to try something else?
At that level, you need to figure out, like, a standardized build order and figure out what you're actually supposed to be doing and then start mass practicing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think at that level, mass practicing, just, like, spamming games like crazy until you get to a much, much higher level, because there's so much for you to learn, and it's all such like small situational stuff. I mean, you really just need the experience of mass games. And then once you get to a higher level, like then you really need to start worrying about practicing efficiently, and spending your time more wisely as you practice and finding ways to practice better. But right now you just need to practice a lot.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex. Hey, silver are people too, guys. Silver are people too. Okay, let's take our next one. Hold it. We just got a message from Scott Smith, but we've got Heath on the line. Heath, welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Hey, what's up, guys?
What's your question? What's up?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Yeah, I'm going into playing a lot more Master Zergs lately, and TVZ, I've been having trouble with kind of like the mass mutaling build. My typical build's kind of like a two racks into like a 9-minute 30 siege tank marine push, and it's kind of just been getting like smashed really early on. I wonder if you guys had any suggestions on what I should do to maybe do better against the composition.
More turtly, and don't push it until you add in Thors and have a lot more marines. Mutaling is the counter to those kind of tank marine timing pushes, because the tanks are really, really beneficial versus banelings, but they put all the gas into mutas and then all the rest of the minerals into tulings. The tanks aren't, they don't do enough. So yeah, if you just see them going really muta heavy and not making much of banelings early, then you need to pull back and wait for two Thors and much more marines, like another 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay. All right.
Paid user, what do you want it?
He pretty much took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say use like two Thors to zone the mutalisks out of your main and your natural. So keep like a Thor and 4 marines, and then another Thor and another group of 4 marines, like floating near, one near main, one near natural, set up turrets and slow push like towards your third, and just be very, very meticulous and careful and properly wall everything off with buildings and just take your time, because if he's committing super heavy to like an all mutalisk, all ling style, eventually if he doesn't do enough damage with the harass, your push, you're just going to crush him, as long as you don't leave yourself open to like a backstab or like a ton of harass damage or anything like that. So just be super, super careful and zone out mutalisks with Thors. And don't push until you get Thors, like he said, because that changes everything.
Is there any way to kind of like scout it before like the push happens? Like, is there any like gas timings I should maybe look for? Or lack of gas?
I mean, you should be pretty aware, just like, it's not like the Zerg is going to be super inactive with his units, right? He's going to be poking and prodding. He's going to be floating around your base with the mutalisk ball. You're going to be able to get a count on how many mutas he has, and you're probably going to be able to get a count on how many lings he has. And if you see a lack of banelings and a huge group of lings, like, just, you know, try and put two and two together.
Yeah, well, I was meaning more of kind of like that, you know, like there's a timing when you push out, like, because if you push out and he's like has the maybe like a macro hatch and he has a lot of lings early, it just kind of surrounds it and it kills all your units and you're really far behind at that point. Is there any way like a scan timing, or is it just kind of you have to really look at the number of lings?
The macro hatch is a pretty good indicator that a really fast tank marine rush isn't going to work. That allows you to get a lot more zerglings, so it's okay to invest all your gas in mutas. So if you see that macro hatch, you're going to want to sit back and play more economically, because Zerg isn't going to have their third base really, really quickly, because they put the third hatch in their main. So then you're more likely to want a turtle. If they put their third hatch at another expansion and it's not particularly early, that's when the marine tank rushes are much, much better.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, Heath. Appreciate it.
They're just tag-teaming these questions,
dude,
bro.
Dude, yeah. Knock them out of the park, man. Let's go ahead and take another one here. We have got RetroGen. Welcome to Inside
Hello.
The Game. Hello.
Sorry, stream cut. First of all, question for Hydra and would be in for In Control. Did you guys send the invitation mail for Assembly summer happening in Finland?
Did we get invited to Assembly?
Did you send the email to try to get the invite? Because it would be awesome to see you guys here.
They've invited me. It's up to my team if I go or not, I think. I don't really know what's going on.
But I was invited to the first one, but I haven't been on a team yet that's willing to send me internationally. It's just too expensive. I think EG should.
Yeah, they certainly can. It's just whether or not we have other priorities.
Yeah, so you might see him out there.
I think pretty much everyone in Finland would love to see EG guys here as well, especially Itra.
Thank you.
All right,
and then I have a quick question concerning the coaching. When you guys think it would be most beneficial for someone to get coaching, apart from when they are ready to pay for it, which is always good reason.
So, like, at what level, like...
If you get the right coach, any level can be worthwhile. At really low level, I think really... Like, once you're confident at executing the absolute basics, that's the best time, because that's when you really need to have build orders laid out for you and to be taught timings. So that's probably the most beneficial up until you reach your some kind of skill plateau, and then you need some kind of outside influence to push you over, and that's when coaching, again, becomes really helpful.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, RetroGen. Appreciate it.
And keep up the good work.
Thank you.
You too. Thanks, man.
Oh, they will. They will.
Oh, will we?
I want to
slave drivers.
I want to give a shout out to the boys over in Burnett Hall, room 19. I'm actually going to be heading over to my first LAN event since like 10 years ago, like where I've gone and I won't be a caster. I get to sit down on a computer and play.
Enjoy, bro.
I'm pretty stoked, man. I won't lie. So if any of those guys are listening over there, looking forward to that shit. Be there soon. Let's take our next caller. We got John on the line. John, welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Hey, how's it going? This question is for Idra. It's concerning the popular Forge Fast Expand into Blink Stalker, like +2 timing. What do you find, I guess, the best way to handle this for Zerg? And do you take how fast do you take your third and et cetera?
Versus fast expansion, if the map allows it, if it's not like Zilnaga or something, you want to take your third hatchery just almost right after your second queen, like before 30 supply, I think, really, really quickly. And then if you're absolutely sure they're going to do the Blinkstalker roll, and then Mass Sling and Fester is actually pretty good. If you're not sure if it's more variable, you think they might be going Stargate or DT or anything else, then you can go Roach Hydra, and just as long as you have, you time out your macro properly, and you get a fourth hatch in time and keep up with your upgrades, and that can work out as well. But Ling and Fester is like the hard counter to it.
Okay. I guess just a thing like for your layer timing, because you're getting that, you need to get Infestors out fairly early to get enough of them to deal with the Blink Stalkers. When do you try to get your layer by? Do you like rush it pretty fast? Or
It varies. You can go either 3-hatch layer or 4-hatch layer ZVP. Both are workable. If you go 4-hatch layer, then you're going to be a lot more unit dependent. You're going to get the Infestors out later to stop like a secondary. You're not going to have them for the first push. You just need more Ling Roach to hold off that. So it's really just whatever you're more comfortable with. I think 4-hatch layer is better in general. It gives you a stronger base to deal with more things. But obviously, the faster Infestors are good against Blinkstalker. So again, it comes down to whether or not you know exactly what they're doing. Like, going lair with your second 100 gas after 3 hatcheries, and then straight into Infestors is quite good against Blink Stalkers, but it's more vulnerable in general.
Okay, you have time. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, John. What was that, pain user?
Oh, I was asking Greg if you have time to get the Infestors out, like if he's doing like a 7 gate.
Not for the initial push, but because you're making a lot of Zerglings with it anyway, because you're really mineral heavy, you can run around and counterattack and make them wait for the second or third round of warp-ins before they actually have enough units to start moving out, and then you can have them.
Gotcha. All right, let's take another call here. We've got Dan on the line. Dan, welcome to Inside the Game. What's up?
Oh, hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Yep.
I have a question about... naming and live events. I've been trying to get new people to watch StarCraft, and I've had some success. One of the concerns I've had is we call everyone by their Battle.net names, which honestly sometimes comes across as a little bit silly, and I kind of wanted to hear stuff like Parsons versus Fields, that kind of thing. What's your guys' opinion on that?
I mean, I feel like at the end of the day, man, we're all gamers. We've all got aliases, and as nerdy and weird as some of them may be, those are our names. That's what people recognize us by. I'm going to be Pain User and Greg's going to be Idra no matter what we do. Even if I walk around calling myself Parsons till the end of time, I think people will still call me Pain User. So I think it's just a matter of everybody just like accepting it and rolling with it. And yeah, I don't see a problem with it at all.
Greg, what do you think? Fields?
It doesn't really matter to me. I mean, I prefer to be called Greg, actually, just because everyone mispronounces my ID. But no, I'm used to being called both, so it doesn't really matter to me.
I'm a huge Nick guy. In regards to the question,
like, are you saying that the people that you're trying to introduce StarCraft to think that it's, like, silly lame that people have aliases? Is that what you're saying?
Sometimes it's a little bit weird introducing someone who's not familiar with gaming and the aliases. So sometimes it sounds a little bit funny trying to explain the aliases first instead of the focus being on the actual, you know, players in the game. I end up having to actually describe what aliases mean and why they exist. And I always thought it was a little bit funny. And you don't really see it too much in the other major competitions where aliases are used primarily. So,
what kind of competitions? Because I've been going to esports competitions for a long time, and it's...
I mean, outside esports, like...
You're like, okay, man, I'm going to start playing basketball, Pain User. I got to come up with a fucking baller ID, man. Let's do... It's not the same. I think that's a part of the culture.
Okay, well, that's what I was asking. I was wondering if you guys think it might ever...
Like, just introducing people who aren't from that culture, it could sound kind of weird or nerdy or whatever. I think it's just kind of something you have to accept because it's so ingrained within esports. Yeah. But I can see where he's coming from.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we've been putting aliases in every game we've bought and naming our characters after ourselves since I was like 7 years old.
I mean, not every sports figure has nicknames, but there are a few out there. I think that someone in chat even says, you know, just relate it in that way. Just be like if everyone was like Pac-Man Jones and had another name that they went by. But I would explain it like it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, we're fucking, these guys are virtual gladiators inside a virtual arena, right? You know, that is their virtual persona, per se. That answer, Pain User?
No, I love the wordage.
Man. It's true. All right.
Dan. All right. Well, thanks for taking the call.
Yep. No problem, Dan. The real answer I wanted to give you is you tell those guys to fucking go to hell. My mom, still this day, she uses all old nicks. Like if she sees someone that she knew from a long time ago, with a nick, she'll call him by their nick. I like that.
It's just the worst having to like explain it sometimes. It's like,
yeah,
and I bet like half of us made these. You know, I made Pain User when I was like 13. It's like I want to inflict pain on my opponent. I'm a Pain User, right? Like, so when people
Pain
ask
User
me,
is pretty newbie Xbox Live, bro. I won't lie.
Oh, dude, I made it when I was 13. Get out of here. It works, though. I'm still going to roll with it. I'm not going to change my name, but it's just so funny when somebody's like, wait, so your nickname's Pain User? Like, well, what does that mean? It's just like, oh.
We got our next caller on the line. We got area code 604 on the line. What's up? Welcome to Inside the Game.
Hi. This is a general question. When I watch even the really high-end pros, say GSL, you still can see a difference in their macro, and I'm trying to understand how. An example I can think of, about a season ago, there was Nada played some other, I think it was Top, in the TVT, and they went for similar builds. But while watching the production tab, there was still a noticeable difference in the macro. Nada was quite far ahead by the time they met up. What is it that really differentiates the top-end pros and the top-end pros, if that makes sense? Like,
teach us a lot of that question makes sense.
10 years of Brood War experience at the highest level, no multiple building select, training is macro mechanics for years, practicing for days
on. Specifics. I've always watched it and tried to see how, what are the little timings that they can put out. I'm not actually asking for advice for myself. It's just when I watch the games, I'm always amazed, not as a really good example, I'm always amazed how far ahead his macro is. And is it to do with distances of his units moved, and what is
like SCV production, hitting depots, production time, production round timings, just all the little stuff. Like,
he's just more efficient than his opponents. He macros more efficiently. He makes more intelligent decisions, and he spends his time more wisely.
Okay, no, because it just seems to me that someone like Top, who practices every day, would.